Once again, we're very happy to have with us our brother Frank Abel for the weekend. The topic of his study weekend is Signs of the Times. The introductory reading we just read was Ezekiel 37, and the topic of his first class is Israel the Spoil. Brother Frank.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here and speaking on this topic. In all my lifetime, I have never, ever seen anything like how prophecy is being fulfilled as it is today. And this will be a means of review to look at the things which should be keeping us right on the edge of our seats as we go through the number of things I'd like to show you this afternoon. Now, I love this chapter, Ezekiel 37, because Ezekiel 37 takes us through the events dealing with Israel, which is our first class. So somewhere in what was read by our brother Paul, we are there prophetically, somewhere in what God says he would do with his people. And I put this slide on first for you, so you could read that as you came in and just think a little bit about this. But this would illustrate to us the blessedness that we have of living today. This man and his life and the fact that he died and the fact that he was so old and making Guinness World Records being the oldest man was certainly drawn to my attention when we're doing this study, because what this illustrates to me is what has happened in the lifetime of people that are still living. Like, we're looking at these dates, 1917, 1948, 1967, 2018. Those are the significant dates. Well, this man saw them all. He died in 2017, so he saw the events that happened in just this past year. But that's really kind of interesting, isn't it? That he would have seen all those significant dates, when in fact the prophecy that we just read was given to Ezekiel about 2,500 years ago. And in that 2,500 years, for 2,400 of those years, people didn't see this. It's just people living today that are seeing these prophecies come to pass. Now, if you have your Bible still open there, and even if you don't, you'll probably remember this idea of opening the graves of the people of Israel. Now, that's got a special meaning for us, because if you've read something about the Dead Sea Scrolls, you will know that in 1956, this was not the real significant first place they found the scrolls, but in 1956, the man in charge, his name was Yigal Yadin, for the Israeli Archaeological Foundation. He was the one that was given the job to go down to Masada to see if he could find any scrolls. And they went around Masada and they dug up this and that and the other, and they found a few little bits and pieces. But one of the things that really was spectacular to them was they found a synagogue. They recognized it as a synagogue because it was facing Jerusalem. And they thought, well, look, there's going to be any scrolls. They're going to be somewhere around that synagogue, because what do you do with an old Bible? What do you do with an old scroll? Well, there'd be very few of us would ever burn a Bible, an old Bible that we had. There's not many of us would even throw it out. We still got them. They're in the house somewhere. That's the respect we have for the book. So what the Jews had been doing was they buried them. It was like having a grave for an old book. They put into what they called a geniza. So they thought there would be one around the synagogue, and they dug up the floor. And looking at the surface of the ground underneath the floor, they found a couple places where it looked like there had been some digging, who knows when, in the past. So they were digging, and they were digging, and in that kind of digging, finding loose soil. They had to be digging with something like a little tiny pick and a brush. And they're going down. They got down maybe 2 to 3 feet, and they found a little bit of something that had writing on it. It wasn't a scroll. It was just a little bit of animal skin that was still there with writing on it. But they were able to identify the writing. It was Ezekiel 37. It was this prophecy about a valley of dry bones, of God bringing them back from all the death places that they had died in around Europe. They came back to the land. Now, for Bible students, that's pretty spectacular. That after all those years of that prophecy, in our lifetime, 1956, well, not everybody was born in 1956, but most of us would have, and a few of us would have recognized this fact. But that's the privilege we have, a tremendous privilege that God is showing to us what he is doing, and it's happening so fast now. This is one of the hardest talks I've ever had to do, because every time you turn the news on, something new has happened, and it affects what you were intending to say. So I had to put at least one new slide in just from something that happened 2 days ago. So it's very difficult to keep it current. Well, this man saw it all. There wouldn't be too many people that could remember things that happened in 1917 that are still living. But 1917 was a very, very significant year. So welcome to our Signs of the Times and our ecclesial study weekend. I hope that it's going to be valuable to you. It's very visual. Okay, so I most of the time, in fact, almost all of the time in these first few talks, you can just look at this and just watch it. I got the slides here. If anyone wants the details on the slides, we're glad to give you the slide set so you can look it over later on. You're not really required to keep up by taking notes. This way we can get a lot more into an hour. Now, the study topics, class one, Israel the spoil. So out of all the things that you could say about Israel, we'd like to identify and work in why Israel is so attractive, that God would illustrate to us in this prophecy in Ezekiel that there's a spoil there. What would that spoil be? And then, of course, class two, Russia the thief. Now, it's just interesting, isn't it? And if you turn the news on the last week, you've heard about Russia, you've heard about Israel. They just all the time seem to be in the news. And then this class three, fit for destruction, is what you might think is kind of negative. But when you look at the Bible prophecies of the Bible, and you see in maybe seven different areas how they're all negative, that's the way it's going to come to the point of the Lord's return. Things aren't going to get better. We're not going to get better and better as we go on. Things are going to get worse and worse as we go on. And we've got to see this for how broadly that is in the life of all those who are living. Class four, the exhortation fits in this theme. Like, you really haven't got all the classes if you've missed the exhortation and if you've missed class five, because all five of them are needed to put the whole theme together. Otherwise, you go away with a bit of an imbalance. If you leave at the end of today and you don't see what comes tomorrow, you're left in a bit of a negative mode for what we've presented. Well, that's because there's a couple things that we haven't finished. So this is one of the most important Bible prophecies with respect to Israel. But you know, there's not many times that we focus on something in a prophecy like that. And what I want to focus on is God's name and what he says he is doing here. And I want to give this flavor to this talk, that Israel is not an independent body that, you know, is just doing something and God says, well, look at what they're doing. No, these people are God's witnesses. They are witnessing to what God said would happen. And hence they are the witnesses that there is a God. You are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, my servant whom I have chosen, that you may know and believe me, and understand that I am he. Before me there was no God form, neither shall there be after me. I, even I, am Yahweh. Beside me there is no Savior. I have declared and have saved, and I have showed, when there was no strange God among you. Therefore you are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, that I am God. You can read that passage without ever seeing that focus. What God's trying to tell us is look to him. You only see God through Israel's witnessing. So Israel's not the critical thing to be watching. It's watching God's hand and seeing that what he said would happen is happening. And this becomes much more spectacular to us. Now, some of these pictures are really revealing. If you've never been to Israel, it's pretty built up around the old city of Jerusalem. It's not as if you can walk out in open fields. There's not too many open fields there. Almost everything is built up or it's walled and you're not allowed in. Well, that's because of the years and years of civilization. But that's the prize spot. That's the focus of the world. So we want to look in this talk at the revival of the descendants of Jacob is recent and ongoing. The revival is the work of their God, not of themselves. The flashpoint is Jerusalem. Jerusalem will fall again. Israel's confidence in the spoil that will attract the nations. Their walls will not stop the invasion, and Israel will be humbled before the kingdom of God is restored. That's our agenda for this first talk. So the Jews back in their land, well, when you think that Tel Aviv, well, a little over 100 years ago, was just sand dunes, that's pretty spectacular. Like almost everything you see about Israel tells you how privileged we are to be alive and why our witness should be so strong and our faith likewise strong, because other people of other ages longed to see these things, never saw them. They saw them prophetically, but they didn't see the reality. That's reality. Joel chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, it says, "Behold, in those days, in that time, when I bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat, and will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land." Now, this is interesting when you see again God introducing himself in this way. When I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem. Well, we've seen both of those. We saw Judah, we saw the state of Israel proclaimed again as one state, like Ezekiel 37 said it would be. Now we've seen Jerusalem, 1967. So again, we're very privileged. And this is the kind of thing that we've got to convey to our children coming up so that they have a faith with respect to what God says. It's God that's telling us this. It's not just a book we're reading. And he says, why I'm doing this, why I'm bringing all nations against them into the valley of Jehoshaphat, is because I'm going to plead with them there for what they've done to my people Israel. And he's also going to work with his own people Israel, as we'll see. So there's some significant things. I'd like to just comment on these individually as we go through it. 1897, 1917, 1947, 1967, 2017. What do you know about those numbers by just looking at them? Well, they all end in 7. And you can see the duplicating dates, like there's 100 years between 1917 and 2017. There's 40 years, there's 70 years. There's all kinds of interesting ways in which you can relate to them. But I just think God is illustrating he's at work. Brothers and sisters, this is no time to have a weak faith. God never gave so many signs, so much evidence of his hand at work, bringing everything to the grand finale as we see before our eyes, we should have a strong faith. Now, this speech is kind of famous because many people would quote this, at least this little citation from it. And many Christadelphians have done that. The Stirrings of Israel's Restoration, Theodore Herzl, in 1897. But I want to draw your attention to something that maybe you haven't seen in it, although we're looking at the same words. When the first Zionist Congress ended, Herzl wrote in his diary, "At Basel, I founded the Jewish state. If I said this out loud today, I would be answered by universal laughter. Perhaps in 5 years, certainly in 50, everyone will know it." Well, within 50 years, look at 1947. In 1947, the United Nations voted to partition the land, and the very next year, the nation was born. Now, what do we think about this man? Well, we don't know, except that that's the way God often works. He will get somebody thinking about something. He'll stir up the heart of somebody, and they will start doing what he wants them to do. You go to the prophet Haggai, the prophet Zechariah, and it tells us that God stirred up the hearts of these people, get them back building that temple. That's what he wanted done. But at Basel, I founded the Jewish state is the problem with Israel today. Instead of saying God prophesied this would happen, and God's about to work to get this to happen, we get people saying, "I did this. It's our strength. It's our might. It's our intelligence." That's the very reason that God's working with Israel. He's working with the other nations as well, but he's working with Israel to get that spirit out of them. So you see it right away in 1897. 1917 was a wonderful year, prophetically. We sometimes don't speak of all the things that happened, and we're not intending to do that, but certainly General Allenby and the British going into Jerusalem in 1917, well, what you really need to do is read the whole story of it, of how the British were able to drive the Turks out of the land at that particular time, and the battles they fought, and how the battles were won, to understand this was a work of God. Things that were happening here were very peculiar to the way God works with people and with nations. But this also was the Bolshevik Revolution. So if there was stirrings for Israel, there was also stirrings for Russia, because God was preparing the world for this event which we are looking at now, and it's a lot easier to believe because we see so much of it. In 1947-48, you may remember that the Jews and the Arabs were at each other's throat prior to 1948. The city was partitioned. There was a lot of problems between the Arabs attacking the Jews and the Jews attacking the Arabs. But when it got to the point of the UN dividing the land and the likelihood of a state coming up, then Jordan, in particular, got into the old city, and they smashed, burned down, and looted all of the Jewish property in the old city and banished the Jews from the old city. Not from all of Jerusalem, but from the old city of Jerusalem. And so there's many pictures of the synagogues. This Herba synagogue, that's the way it looked in 1947 after the Jordanians got rid of it. And that's what it looks today after it's been restored. But you got to see these things to really see all of the things that happened and the significance in 1947-48. 1967 probably is a little bit more easily to be remembered by most of us. We're old enough and paying attention at that time in 1967. You may even remember where you were during that Six-Day War. You may remember the influence it had in your life. And I could never forget it myself, because at the time that war started, I was due to give a series of lectures in Brisbane, Australia, on Israel coming back to the land. And if you remember, the nature of that war was in the first couple days of the war, no one knew what was happening because there was so much false information out there. If you believe what the Egyptians were saying, Israel was just about finished. Only to find out halfway through that it was Egypt that was just about finished because of the surprise attack that they made on the air bases in Egypt. So it taught us a few things about that. It was a very exciting time. So I remember the ecclesias in Australia that we visited at that time where the lectures were held. And they were cutting everything they could out of the newspapers and putting them all over the walls of the hall as you came in. So you could see, you know, Israel was in the news and how the news was changing about what was happening. And then, of course, all over in 6 days. No one really that followed that through would ever forget the reason why they claim it was just a six-day war. How can you fight a war in 6 days? Well, that's good reading. Every Christadelphian should know that and have something to read to get all the details of it. But now we see in 2017 something that stirred up the wrath of the Palestinians, stirred up the hope of the Jews in ways which other presidents of the United States have never been able to do, because they weren't going to make the embassy move to Jerusalem. And not only that, this president seems like he's actually going to do it. Not just to say he's going to do it, which caused enough of a problem itself, but that he actually has now a date when he will move the embassy to Jerusalem. Now, with the wrath that's already been stirred up about this, you can well imagine that Jerusalem's going to be a hot topic in the news for months to come, if there are months to come before the Lord returns. Now, just go back to the city again. It gives you a much bigger picture of it. Look at, there's buildings everywhere. Like, it's hard to find any empty space in Jerusalem to build anything new. Usually something's got to be torn down in order to get the room to build anything new. But that is the coveted spot in the world. There's no spot like that. And look at what the Bible has to say about it. Yahweh chose Zion. Psalm 132, verse 13 and 14. For Yahweh hath chosen Zion. He hath desired it for his habitation. This is my rest forever. Here will I dwell, for I have desired it. Now, where do you hear that in today's news? That this is God's city. Well, no one would understand what you meant anyway if they said it was God's city. Do you mean Allah? Do you mean, you know, they probably wouldn't even know the name Yahweh. It's left to us, brothers and sisters, to tell, no, this is Yahweh. This is not God as people think of God in today's world who know nothing about the Bible. This is not the Allah God of the Arabs. This is the God who is the author of the Bible, the creator of the world. He says, this city is my city. I've chosen this. It's my habitation. That's where I'm going to rest forever. Where do you hear that in the news? That's left for us to say and to tell the world. Not only that, he goes on to say, who is his people, his land, and his purpose? In Ezekiel 38, verse 16, he says, to the Gogian host, thou shalt come up against my people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land. And it shall be in the latter days, and I will bring thee against my land, that the heathen of the nations may know me when I shall be sanctified in thee, O Gog, before their eyes. Who in the world's telling people that? Except us. You know, brothers and sisters, I don't know if you remember this, but back in 1967 when these things were happening and some of the turmoil years of 1973 and the Yom Kippur War and things like that, the Christadelphians got together. Like, there'd be enough of you in Detroit to do something like this. And they bought a full page in the newspaper. And they put on a big splash ad about what God said he would do. This is the work of the God, the author of the Bible, the creator of the world. Got a lot of interest. And in those days, they'd be before the seminars. And people were taking courses. So you would sign people up for a Bible correspondence course. After that, people got into seminars. I don't know where people are on that today, but These are possibilities. We're going to have exciting times in the future. Are we ready? Do we have people that can write articles? Do we have any articles that are just waiting for the opportunity? Do we have a fund somewhere where we can appeal to money very quickly if we need to get something in a newspaper with a week's notice? Do we have a place where we could go and invite the public, where we could rent a facility that could hold a few hundred people and would be good to, you know, in a good central area where people could come? We are going for a very exciting ride when God actually does this in its fullest way. But Israel has its master plan. And thanks to Don Pierce, mainly with the snippets file. So I read that all the time. It takes a lot of time to read that file. He puts so much information out there that I tell you, usually if I leave that out late at night, I can hardly see when I'm finished. But look at their plan. Like there's no international airport down here. There's the Jordan River. There's the Dead Sea. This is just a flat area. There's nothing much of anything there. They plan to put an airport down there. These are the boundaries of Greater Jerusalem. So Israel has a big plan for Jerusalem. No wonder it's going to be, you can just imagine how the Arabs would complain about that, because in many cases that's not land that's within their boundaries and never was within their boundaries. So it's going to be kind of interesting to see how that works out. So God tells us in Ezekiel 36, because Ezekiel 36, 37, 38, 39 are the chapters where we have so much detail about this. And I think this is important, and this is the flavor we want to give our talks. We really would like people to see this. Ezekiel 36, 22, 23, "Therefore say unto the house of Israel, thus saith the Lord Yahweh, I do not this for your sakes, O house of Israel, but for mine holy name's sake, which you have profaned among the nations whither you went. And I will sanctify my great name, which was profaned among the nations, which you have profaned in the midst of them. And the nations shall know that I am Yahweh, saith the Lord Yahweh, when I shall be sanctified in you before their eyes." Now that's not going to happen by any ways that you can see the nations analyzing the news. They don't factor that in at all, that God will be finally sanctified in the eyes of the nations of the world by what he does with Israel. If someone doesn't make it known to people what God is doing with Israel and showing them the details of this, that's not going to happen easy. I wanted to tell you a little story about this because when Brother Paul Billington and I went on one of our video tours in Israel to try to get something for the Bible magazine, we had a little bit of time before we left from the Lod International Airport near Jerusalem. And as we're driving down the road, we saw this place at Latrun. It's not far from the airport. And we thought, well, you know, it's kind of an interesting place. It looks like it's the gates open. It's an army base. So we drove in and, you know, no one seemed to bother. We parked the car and walked around and found all these weapons of war there. And so we thought, well, we'll just do a little taping here because this would make a good tape. So one of those tapes, I don't know which one it was, has this on it. And these weapons were mainly weapons that were captured by Israel in the 1967 war. Some of them were Israeli weapons that had been used in the war, and they were just kept there. So people, when they came to train in Israel, they'd come to this base at Latrun, and they would learn things about the various weapons of other nations. Probably the most outstanding weapon that was in there was a Palestinian tank. And it had the character of being painted bright blue. You said, why would anybody paint a tank bright blue? Because they usually are camouflage. If you see a bright blue thing, you mean it's a target right away. And apparently the reason why that was bright blue is because the Palestinians were more afraid of the devil than they were of the enemy. And that was to ward off the devil. Never mind the enemy. So it and it's there. It was in that collection. So to do a video, a short video, you had to be able to say it properly. It would take about 3 or 4, maybe a little longer, up to 5 minutes to say this. And when you said it the first day, you didn't have time for notes. So you just had to make this up. You just had to have the Bible passages in your mind and go through it. And I had to go through on this one, Zechariah 14, talk about Jerusalem. We talked about Micah chapter 4. We talked about Joel chapter 3. And we have got a little bit into Daniel. So I went through it once. Then I noticed there's a soldier come out. He stood by the camera. He's got his gun and everything. You know, he's looking down. It wasn't what we expected, but then we didn't ask for permission. So I had to go through this with that little extra nervousness about 5 times. So this soldier heard this 5 times running, the same story about what was going to happen to Israel. What we wanted to illustrate was Israel's going to be clobbered in this next war. So I thought, well, they're going to have to face the music sometime. You've got to stop this and go up and talk to this man. So we did. We went up to talk to him, and I tell you, we couldn't believe what this man said. Now, this was a younger man, and he would be of the character of the settlers. And if you've been following the Bible magazine, you know that the settlers have a different spirit in them than the average Israeli. And this man said to me, in the best he could speak with English, because he wasn't really real fluent in English, he said, "I agree with everything you said, except I don't agree that Jerusalem will fall again." He says, that happened in 1947. Well, it did, because they were driven out of the old city by the Jordanians in 1947. And he thought that was the answer to Zechariah 14. But you know what he said? He said, "I am really pleased that someone would come from America who knew enough about the prophets to talk about this sort of in a proper way, like saying what he believed himself. Instead of being ready to shoot us, like, here's the pen, get in there and tell the sentence, and then we can finish you off." He was very, very good to talk to. But he only talked to us for about 5 minutes when a man from the gate came up to find out what's going on here, like, what's all this excitement? And this man was a Jew of a different background altogether. He didn't believe anything the Bible had to say. I don't know if he knew anything about what the Bible had to say. And he just scoffed at everything. That's the mixture in Israel. And God will recognize, well, he must recognize that mixture, because there's going to be people that will come through the battle that will be Israeli, and they will certainly deal with the nations as God says it would. So it's a very interesting aspect. Now that's Jerusalem, and that's Jerusalem today, because that picture was taken not so long ago. Jerusalem will fall again. How do we know? Well, look at what it says. Zechariah 14, verses 1. "Behold, the day of Yahweh cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then shall Yahweh go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle." Now, there's a couple of things about those three verses that will obviously illustrate it couldn't have been 1947. Certainly, Yahweh didn't go forth and fight against those nations as he fought in the day of battle. And there wasn't any captivity that I'm aware of that took place in that time. They were banished from the old city, but the Jews weren't taken captive and sold for slaves or something. And just how much these details would have been fulfilled, it doesn't fit. I think the young man was certainly hoping this would not happen again. But it's going to happen again, because it's never happened yet. And it's got to happen for God to show forth himself to fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. Well, this is the problem, brothers and sisters. When you look at Israel, who could, if they would speak about their heritage with the Old Testament prophets, they have a lot to say to this world. I mean, they would be saying what we would be saying if given the opportunity. But no, that's just their confidence. This new fighter, this F-35 they got from America, that's what they talk about. Their guns, their ability to fight in war, their training, their Iron Dome missiles, how they can defend their cities, and their miles and miles and miles of fence. That's Israel's confidence. And all you got to do is just read what the Israelis say about themselves and what the world has to say about Israel to know that that's true. They have Iron Dome defenses in the sea now. They've taken that missile set and taken out to the oil rigs because they're very much afraid that those oil rigs are a sitting duck, can be destroyed so easily, and they don't get built overnight, and they're cost millions and millions of dollars. So now they think they've got them defended. They got these drones. These are big drones, not the little ones that a soldier can have and can set forth himself. These are ones that would be armed, so they could fly into an area and take out a target. Something like the ones that recently entered Israeli airspace from Syria, which was built by the Iranians. And the Iranians got the plan from the Americans because they caught one of their drones and reverse engineered it to make their model of it. So it's just an amazing thing that goes on out there. It's just that it takes you hours and hours of reading to keep up to date on what's going on. This is Israel's confidence. So this is from the Debka file, January 30th. And this man who is the chief of staff, Eisenkot, I am confident the Israeli Defense Forces will prevail in a war. So the IDF's chief of staff, Lieutenant Gadi Eisenkot, sounded for the first time Tuesday as though he was addressing a potential war with Hezbollah. He said, there are many challenges facing us amidst the apparent calm on the northern border. Hezbollah, in breach of UN resolutions, maintains a military presence and weapons systems and is constantly enhancing its capabilities. The IDF works day and night to stay ready and retain its deterrent strength. He went on to say, we shall continue to advance our knowledge of the enemy and take action to restrain its capabilities. I am absolutely sure of our military superiority. Trust in the high quality of our commanders and troops, and confident in our ability to achieve victory in the event of war. That would never have made the news headlines in the Old Testament when people went out against war. Their confidence wasn't in themselves. It wasn't in their nation or in their army. If it was probably only because they were going to lose in the battle. This absolutely sure of our military superiority has got to change. That's the one thing that we see coming out of this. Now, I don't know if you can remember this. Some of you will remember this. I feel certain of this, that there used to be a booklet that was written by, I think it was Percy Bilton. I can't remember exactly the author, but it was from England. It was a little pamphlet, and it was about spoil. What was the spoil of Israel? And that's the way he spelt it. He capitalized O-I-L. And that's without finding a drop of oil in Israel at the time. And we worked with that over the years when we had to talk about why would Russia ever want to come down into Israel. It wasn't so much that they wanted to come down on Israel. We saw them coming down into the Middle East because of the Arab oil that seemed to be placed by God in Arab lands, not in Israeli lands. That's what we thought when we first thought of this oil thing. So Ezekiel 38, verses 12 and 13, the Russian, or the Gogian host, I should say that at this stage, came to take a spoil, to take a prey, to turn their hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations, which have gotten cattle and goods and then dwell in the midst of the land. And Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish with all the young lions thereof shall say unto thee, art thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou gathered thy company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, and to take a great spoil? And we still wrestle with that. And we can only imagine with what we've seen what that spoil would be. And I'm going to show you a few things you may not have seen. But it certainly it was an illustration of the fact that brethren at that time thought the spoil would be oil, Arab oil. But that's Israeli. That's an Israeli rig drilling for oil somewhere just off the coast of Tel Aviv. In 2009, they found the Tamar field. And that was a big discovery to see oil and gas anywhere within Israel's limits. Then they found the big one, Leviathan, in 2010. Then in 2016, they found oil in Jerusalem. We'll talk about this a little bit later on. And then in 2017, in fact, they found not only in Jerusalem, they found it in the Golan Heights in 2016. And now they're working in Jezreel, the plain of Jezreel. And they have discovered oil there, but they haven't yet published any amount, how much oil there is there. But that's, we'll comment on that a little later on. So you can see where these fields are. They're just off the coast. Leviathan being out further out here, but as far as Israeli's sort of area of limit goes, when you've got to deal with Cyprus, you've got to deal with Egypt, you've got to deal with Turkey, everybody's now finding their piece of the Mediterranean. And one of the big disputes between Lebanon and Israel is whether the line should go out like this, or the line has a slight demarcation this way. Israel wants the bigger slice, but Lebanon wants what they feel is you can see the strife that's there. But it's a huge amount, and the reason why that's important will be apparent in just a few slides. So here you see one of the slides that I managed to get recently, because it's a complicated thing. It's not just Israel finding oil. It's the found now that it's that Lebanon is drilling for oil, Syria's interested in their part, Cyprus is interested in their part, Turkey's interested in their part, Egypt wants their part, and now they're squabbling over what they can find. And this big field here is actually claimed in the literature to be bigger than Leviathan. This is Egypt's field. Now, isn't it interesting that Egypt should have such a huge find of oil at this time in history? Now look at this, brothers and sisters, you concentrate on this. This is recent stuff. 2009 was when they found the first field. Here we are in 2018, so just 10 years, and all these discoveries are coming now, and all of a sudden, this area is becoming a huge source of oil. I didn't know anything about it for 2,400 years. Our day, happening at that time in history, which I think God is in full control of, and is just illustrating that these are the things which will bring all nations down to Jerusalem. But that's not the only thing. Israel is noted around the world for its startup companies, its ability to make discoveries, new ways of doing things that haven't been actually worked out. So you got drones, autonomous vehicles, like many of the things that allow a vehicle to drive without a driver, have been designed in Israel first. Finance, augmented reality, medical devices, all kinds of areas where Israel is standing out in the world and being able to get businesses started. And I thought this was kind of interesting, because Israel is considered to be the land of milk and honey, but it's also considered to be the land of tech and money, which has a little bit of a different ring to it. But the future belongs to those who innovate. Israel is seizing the future with 8.5 million people. It has more companies on NASDAQ than almost any other country outside of North America, ranks third in the World Economic Forum's ranking of most innovative economies. Israel's startups receive nearly 20% of global private investment in cybersecurity, punching 200 times above our relative weight. Israel recycles 87% of its wastewater, five times more than the runner-up. Israel's cows produce more milk per animal than those of any other country. I thought, this is kind of amazing. This little country, people have come back and they've really only got to work just in the last century. And yet it's making an impact on the world, making nations which are 10 times more population, been around and working for centuries and centuries, but never come up with this. Why is this happening? Well, as you can imagine, there's a bit of resentment. But Israel is one of the highest educated nations in the world. And you can see the research and development centers in Haifa, Tel Aviv, Beersheba, Jerusalem, and up in the Golan area. All areas where they seem to be separated in some kind of a pattern. You can see the companies that are investing in those areas, or many of these are American companies that have research. I just couldn't believe this one down here, and it's just, there's a place just, well, this area of Gaza would be down in here, and just near Gaza in the city of Gath, the old city of Gath, not actually in the old ruins, but where the city of Gath was, Intel has built this huge plant to build chips. And during a time when the Palestinians were trying to hit Tel Aviv with missiles from Gaza, Intel announces a $2 billion expansion of the factory. Well, missiles are going over top. And this is crazy. No one would do that. They would pull their resources out of the nation. But they're so confident that Israel can handle it, they go ahead anyway. And so all these nations, which you would think they'd be scared out of these places, they're all in Israel, working on it. This was interesting. It's not as if this is the first time this has happened, because people knew you could get water from air. But it took a Jewish company to do this, using 1 kilowatt of energy to produce 1 gallon of drinking water. So that gives you an idea of a new, easier method or way they've done it, certainly much cheaper. This is controlled by a Russian-Israeli billionaire. It's interesting, the connection between Russia and Israel in the way Israel's developing. And eyes the mass assembly of water-producing units by year-end. WaterGen Limited, an Israeli company whose technology captures humidity in order to make drinking water out of the air, is not likely to experience the cash flow squeeze that afflicts many fast-growing companies, because you got a billionaire behind it. But you think of the import of that in countries which don't have water, like what's recently happened down in the very bottom of South Africa, where a nation runs out of water. What do you do? Or nations which have suffered some catastrophe, like a huge storm went through and there's no water safe to drink. But these kind of methods and doing it cheap enough illustrate how Israel is taking advantage of every little niche they can to do things which, you can look at it to say help the world, or you can look at it as a way to advance their economy. All these devices born in Israel. That's the way Israel faces the world. Look at what we can do. If you've listened to the speeches of Netanyahu, you know that's what he presents to the world. Look at what Israel can do for you. And so I don't want to go through all of those things, but you can just see the number of things that have been developed in Israel. United Nations ranks the Israeli Defense Force emergency medical team as number one in the world. Able to take something and go to a place where they've had an earthquake and a lot of people are needing hospital care or some other catastrophe, can set it up and can offer people something that can't be obtained at that quality anywhere else in the world. This little nation of Israel. It's just amazing how they can do that. But getting back to the city and the problem there, Jerusalem in 2018 is still a divided city. This old city, you can see the walls here. This is the area of the old city. And it's the old city that's the city in dispute. This is East Jerusalem. That's the city in dispute. West Jerusalem's a different situation altogether. The Arabs wouldn't mind Israel having that because that was in that, there are borders anyway. It's this part of the land, the old city. So you got the Latin quarter, you got the Arab quarter, you got the Jewish quarter, and you got the Greek quarter. Do you realize how that represents the world? If you started here, you just think of the Arab nations, no matter which kind of an Arab or which kind of a Muslim you happen to be, you're all interested in that being retained for the Arabs and the Muslims. So you get hundreds of millions of people interested in the outcome of that. You got the Jews. There's how many Jews there are, but a lot of very influential, rich people in the world, very interested that that remains Jewish. I'll go up to the Latin Quarter. The Latin Quarter is essentially Europe. That's where the Catholic Church has its interest, in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and places like that. That's what they want. They want their quarter. This is the Greek Catholic Church. They want their quarter. They're down there in the Church of the Nativity, and they have other places where they're interested in. So when you think of the Greek Catholic Church and the influence that has, and the fact that Russia is more related to this group than any other group, you've really got the world being represented in that little piece of real estate. No wonder God said, and said so accurately with his prophets back in Ezekiel, that's where this is going to be settled. The nations will be drawn to Jerusalem. So you got the Muslims, Dome of the Rock. That's the most prized position because that is built on, they believe, the remnants of the old temple. So the Jews and the Muslims, the Jews would love to get rid of that, and the Muslims are, God's given them control because the Jews would do something God doesn't want them to do. And so that's sitting there until the right time. You got the Jewish, that's what they got, the remnants of Herod's temple. They can look at it, it below a certain level where they can be sure that it was Herod's temple. You got the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. That was really interesting what happened this week. Hot off the press, February the 25th. They closed the doors. Why did they close the doors? Because there was a dispute between the Catholic Church and the State of Israel on taxation. Not taxation of this place, but because some of these churches own land that doesn't have any church on it. And they were selling it off to other people, and they weren't paying any taxes because they said the church owned it. So what the church people decided to do, and we'll just close this up, we'll just let the world get angry over this. Well, it was only a couple days, and the law was written down. And no way they're going to have that law. The Jews backed off. And it just illustrates the power of that city. They just go to their quarter. What did we think about this? We don't want it. Get up and say something. And that quieted that one down. So this is the Armenian St. James Cathedral, which is also in the old city. Like just all of these things crammed into this little piece of real estate. I wanted to bring this to you, though, because this is one. It's not in the old city. The wall would just be down here. There's the Church of All Nations, and here's the Church of Mary Magdalene. And that's Russian. That's owned by the Russian Orthodox Church. See, Russia's got real estate in Jerusalem. And it's interesting how this is going back, you know, maybe two centuries when these places were built. But they were built, it seems, so that these people would see they have roots there and are not going to give them up. But they also have the Holy Trinity Cathedral in Jerusalem. That's Russian. They also have this church built in Ein Kerem. That's also in Jerusalem. And believe it or not, on the Mount of Olives, this tower is Russian. You see all these Russian places all in the city of Jerusalem. No wonder Russia is interested in Jerusalem. No wonder Europe and the Catholic Church is in Jerusalem. No wonder the Arabs are all interested in Jerusalem. No wonder the Jews are interested in Jerusalem. Like, this is a foregone conclusion when you look at the background of these places, why these people want this, and they're not going to give up their interest. But this is still alive in the world too. This is a recent thing. And it says in Micah chapter 4, speaking about the times which we expect will happen, "Now also many nations are gathered together against thee that say, let her be defiled, let her eye look upon Zion." You'd have to be kind of evil in your mind to go to an old gravesite and mark it with a swastika. That's anti-Semitism. Is it time for the Jews to leave Europe? Well, that's a question being asked because, as we read in the news that comes through, it says, for half a century, memories of the Holocaust limited anti-Semitism on the continent. That period has ended. The recent fatal attacks in Paris and Copenhagen are merely the latest examples of rising violence against Jews, renewed vitriol among the right-wing fascists, and new threats from radicalized Islamists have created a crisis confronting Jews with an agonizing choice. Like, this just won't go away. God seems to be forcing more and more Jews back to the land. From the Atlantic Daily. Boycott. I don't know if you read this, but this has been very active in the last year, the boycott of Israel. So it's the boycott of any companies that do business or support Israel. Well, that's all the companies. It gives you an idea of how many American, Canadian, European companies that they want to boycott, trying to get citizens, don't shop there, don't have any business with any of these companies. Well, I'll tell you, when you start looking at some of those icons and you start recognizing it, there's got to be some Jewish connection with that company. Either the Jews own a share or a major share, or they own the place outright. But a lot of these are places that we would frequent when you look at that. UNESCO stated May 13th, 2017. Now, this is United Nations. This was set up in 1945 for education, science, and culture. And it stated, and this is just one of the things, any action taken by Israel, the occupying power, to impose its laws, jurisdiction, and administration on the city of Jerusalem are illegal and therefore null and void and have no validity whatsoever. That's United Nations. That's what they think of the Jews and what they're doing in the land. So it adopted the resolution with just 22 members voting in favor, 10 voting against, 23 abstaining. Israel has long complained the bias at the UN forums, where it and its allies are often outnumbered by Arab nations and others that support the Palestinians. You can just see the agitation at level after level of things relating to the city of Jerusalem. Again, you look at those faces, and you know where that picture came from. So, again, the Debka file that Brother Don Pierce sends to us occasionally. The Poland's Senate passes a controversial Holocaust bill. What did it say? Well, the news item said, the Polish upper house passed by 57 votes to 23 with two abstentions, the bill making it illegal to accuse Poles of complicity in the Nazi Holocaust against fines or a maximum 3-year jail sentence. It also prohibits describing Nazi death camps in Poland, where 3 million Jews perished, as Polish. The measure has caused a rift with Israel, which accuses Poland of attempting to change history. The U.S. also asked the Polish government to rethink the measure, lest it undermine free speech in Poland and cause further diplomatic controversy. The bill must be signed by the president before becoming law. I understand it was signed. Just illustrating how people feel about the Jews. and general around the world. But in Micah chapter 4 continues on. We read that verse. But they know not the thoughts of Yahweh, neither understand they his counsel, for he shall gather them as sheaves into the floor. And the time will come, and God says, arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion. I will make thine horn iron, I will make thy hoofs brass. Thou shalt beat in pieces many people, and I will consecrate their gain unto Yahweh, and their substance unto the Lord of the whole earth. Like, that's the end of this. This is where we are. Certainly that is true, but God's gathering them to that site as sheaves into the floor for a time of threshing. That's the work of God and what's happening. Now, I just want to spend a little bit of time on this because a lot of people have difficulty with this part of the prophecy. Because the prophecy says that they would go up against a nation in Ezekiel 38 without walls and no bars and no gates. And there's probably more walls in Israel than any other nation around when it comes to trying to defend themselves from the attacks of neighbors at this particular time. I mean, these are huge, these walls that go around, and they do effectively form a barricade where you can then concentrate on a gate and focus the army's attempts to keep people back in just one location. So Ezekiel 38 verse 11 says, thou shalt say, I will go up to the unwalled, a land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls, having neither gates, bars, nor gates. Now it depends how much time you thought about this and how you develop what's said there. If you think that there can't be any walls or any gates, there's got to be a tremendous transformation in Israel. Because now they're building walls under the ground, trying to stop these tunnels from Gaza. And these are going down, you know, almost to, in some cases, to 100 meters with the rods that go down to detect any movement in the land and the ground around Gaza. So, I mean, why would you remove them? You just leave them there. You didn't want them. So we really have to think about this. Why is it that they go up to what they say is a place of unwalled villages? Well, I want you to think of this, because this is just one resolution of this difficulty. But if you read the scriptures and you go over and over this, many, many times walls are spoken of in a figurative sense. He that has no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down and without walls. You ever thought that in our own mind, we're defenseless? We don't have any walls in our mind because we have never learned the discipline that's needed to rule our own spirit. That's a figurative use. Psalm 51, the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise. Do good in thy good pleasure unto Zion. Build thou the walls of Jerusalem. Well, there's no time that God sent his angels to go out and build a wall in Jerusalem. Like, that's got to mean something else than Yahweh himself going out and building it. He could, but that's obviously not what it means. Because if we go on, we can see that in Isaiah 26, it says, in that day shall this song be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. God doesn't need literal walls, literal gates and bulwarks around a city to defend it. He defends it with salvation. So if we all died, our believers will be resurrected again. That's how God delivers people in a crisis. And we learn to trust in our God because of that. But you've got to look at the walls in the way they are portrayed in the scriptures. Isaiah 62, he says, I have set watchmen upon thy walls, O Jerusalem, which never hold their peace day nor night. Ye that make mention of Yahweh, keep not silence. Give him no rest till he establish, till he make Jerusalem a praise in the earth again. Well, you don't have to be standing on the walls in Jerusalem to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. There's watchmen all over the world who are praying those prayers, and they are figuratively on Jerusalem's walls. You see these walls, I mean, they're formidable in the sense of trying to keep people out. So any infiltrator trying to get through a wall like that would not only set off sensors, but it'd be pretty hard in your body to get through that kind of laser wire. Except Yahweh build the house, they labor in vain. So I really believe that Yahweh is the one who is providing the wall for Jerusalem. And if he takes away his hedge, it doesn't matter how high your walls are, literally, you're defenseless. But we'll have a little more to say on that coming up. This is the last slide, and I want to just say this because this is where we wanted to end. This is what Netanyahu said. This is the way he looks at things. And he said this many times. He says, today Israel is more welcomed by the nations of the world than ever before. Our economy is booming. Our formulations are flourishing. Our army is more powerful than ever. Our unique, our indispensable alliance with America is growing from strength to strength. When I look forward 50 or 100 years, I believe Israel will be embraced openly by its Arab neighbors, rather than in secret in the way it's done today. I see Israel as a world power that continues to provide cutting-edge technology and innovation to help people around the world. I see a thriving relationship between Israel and the Jewish communities, no matter how they pray and where they're from. I see, in short, a glorious future of prosperity and peace for Israel. But that requires confronting the challenges as we seize the opportunities. We'll do both. Thank you. Where's his God? Where did he elevate the God of Israel? Where did he mention anything that God has done in the past? One of the greatest disappointments I ever had was to go to the Holocaust Museum in Israel, in Jerusalem, Yad Vashem, and look in there to see if there was anything that related to God. I never found a single exhibit that mentioned the word God. They have not learned their lesson. And this pride that Israel has, illustrating that we will do these things, 50, 100 years, look, we're going. No one's going to do anything to us at all. That's got to be broken. And our next talk is dealing with the nation God has assigned to do that task. Thank you.